Accession number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Real 5. Now, we were talking about your time with 4 Squadron, which is part of 6th Initial Training Wing at Aberystwyth. Were you there
from
the very back end of December 1940? What about your wireless and signals training? Can we talk about that? You'd had a bit of training in Morse code, but this is where you got it properly, isn't it?
Yes, we really started getting into it in the official manner. And we used to sit in a classroom, and there was a buzzer available for each person, and we followed the instructor, and he sort of taught us by example rather than anything else. And it wasn't just a question of learning the Morse code as individual letters. We had done that previously, some of it of our own volition with a piece of equipment one of our comrades arrived with. And we then started by putting words together and learning what you might say groups of sounds, which made the words up, 2 or 3 letters at a time. I mean, the obvious example is SOS, which people learnt very quickly. And this followed with other words until you could take down a sentence largely by listening to groups. It was a slow process. We were aiming to get up to 6 words a minute, both sending and receiving, before we left the course. This I think was scheduled for something like 12 weeks in all, and we progressed with that. Where we did also have training in signalling was, of course, outside in one of the long roads of Aberystwyth, where we did it with a lamp, such as the Navy used between ships, so that they don't have to divulge their position with radio signals. And I personally found getting up to speed with the lamp, it's easy enough to send, but the receiving I did find some difficulty with. I can't explain it. Some people were perhaps more observant, or perhaps they could concentrate more than I did. Being outside, there was other things going on, like traffic and the like. But I made the grade in the end, but I found the lamp work to be quite hard graft.
Were you given any training in wireless? I mean, the sort of how to use wireless in the sense of just and maintain, you know, and keep it going, keep the valves going. And
we had the general principles of radio, a bit about frequencies and the like. I can't really remember a great deal of the training other than the practical work. We certainly had a number of lectures and diagrams drawn for us, but it hasn't stuck in my memory to a degree that perhaps other subjects have.
Now, what else was happening while you were there? You seem to have, one notable thing seems to be some sort of Kader Idris, it says 9th of March 1941.
Oh,
what was that about?
Well, that in actual fact was at the end of the course. We had run.
Is there anything you want to deal with before that then? Sorry,
just in general sort of matters. I could mention that being in the centre of town, then we did have the normal sort of shopping facilities and entertainment. There was cinemas and also a music hall type building. We went there because some of our people put on a show evening. The main thing that I remember, there was that a chap from our group, John King, who joined practically as soon as he was 18 into the Air Force, and he seemed to be quite a skilled musician in many ways, and his act, if you call it that, was to play the saw. And I still have strong memories of him sitting up on the stage there with this large carpenter's saw, and stroking it with a bone. You got quite the amazing sounds from it. I don't think that was original. It had been done before on the radio, but at least he can produce recognisable and popular tunes. So that was part of the entertainment. We did use the Pier Café. The Lion Royal was at the head of a road, and as you went straight down towards the sea, then the entrance to the pier was close by. And that had been chopped in the middle, I think, to prevent it being used as a landing point should any invasion come that way. But the cafe itself was quite extensive. And we had free use of going there in the evening, whatever studying one wanted to do, or notes to write up, or just to sit and chat and have a cup of coffee and the like. It was a warm and welcoming place, which was close to to the Lion Royal. There was, I'm not sure whether I mentioned it, just around the corner from the Lion Royal was a bakery. And we frequented that because their Chelsea buns were superb. I don't think I've tasted as good anywhere else. The other perhaps unusual thing was also in the same road on the other side. There was a laundry which I and quite a number of other people took stuff into. And the young girls behind the counter were all Chinese, as was the owner. And it was quite strange to hear them speaking English with a strong Welsh accent. But they did a good job, so there was certainly no complaints. Where else did we go? Oh, we used to go up onto the hill on the north end of the promenade. There was good views from there. I think it was called Constitution Hill. There was a sort of funicular up there, but mostly a little short of money, we used to climb up on the footpath, and perhaps on a Sunday afternoon or a day which was fine and we hadn't got lectures on, then it was quite a popular stroll up there for the exercise, if nothing else.
Now, so the next thing would be this this thing at the end of the course, which is in March, 9th of March 1941.
Oh, Cader Idris.
Cader Idris.
Yes.
Now, what's this about?
Oh, this was purely a walk. Yes, I suppose you'd call it a walk. Organised by the flight lieutenant who was in charge of our flight, our group of people. He hired a coach, which on a Sunday morning we piled into it, dressed in whatever we liked. We weren't in uniform necessarily, and it took us up to the lake Talilin, I think it is, in the hills, and we then commenced to haven't got there. Didn't line up, we just sort of formed up in a straggly line, and he led the way up a flowing stream, and we came to a lake in a horseshoe shape series of ridges with the lake in the bottom there. We had to walk round the lake before we started the next part of the climb, which was quite steep in many ways. And of course, then it being rather a cloudy day, we ran into the mist. And it's just as way, well, it's, what was his name? Flight Lieutenant Dickey, I think. Just as well as old Dickey knew the route. He had done it more than once with previous courses. So we got to the top of Cader Idris, and there we were in the mist. But there were one or two photographs were taken. It wasn't much good staying up there long because we didn't get a break. And we went down a different way, which seemed to be more of a straight run down rather than the tortuous route that we had gone up. And we finished up at a pub down by the lake. And we sort of pleaded more or less that we were travellers, so that on a Sunday afternoon, then we managed to get a drink. And the coach turned up. He had been waiting for some hours for us, and we were quite happy to get into the warm and return back to Aberystwyth. But that was an outing which was purely a pleasure trip.
Now, around about this time, you were made LAC. Is that leading aircraftman?
That's right.
Is that because you'd passed a qualification? What was that for?
Yes, we passed through the course. As I say, the Cadarajus trip was taken right at the end. We stayed on a couple of three extra weeks. We did more than the required 12, I think it was. And this was one of the things that, having passed the course with reasonable marks and what have you, then you got promoted to LAC, jumping the AC1, which we didn't have anything to do with.
That was in March 1941.
Yes. Well, that really was the end of the period at Aberystwyth.
And what was your next post? It looks like you go to Wilmslow, but is that a proper posting or is that just a holding?
That was a holding. We had a form given to us, and on it was the authority to travel. Most of us, I think, all heading for the same place, although in some other courses I understand had gone to South Africa. But we really didn't know where we were heading for. We'd been issued with our flying kit in Aberystwyth, and also amongst it we'd been given khaki drill, shorts, trousers, tunics, what have you, so we didn't know whether it was going to be hot or not. The rumour was that had we been given khaki that we should go to South Africa. Anyhow, we went up to Wilmslow. We were there for two or three days. We went into town, I think, probably once or twice. I remember buying a money belt there, and that's about the only remarkable thing I can remember of it. We then took a train overnight, and we went to Gourock, which is on the outskirts of Glasgow and is a port on the Clyde. And we pulled up into this big train shed, so to speak, and there was a lot of us on board. It wasn't just us lot from Aberystwyth, it was other people. And we then immediately walked across to the quayside and up the gangplanks onto the Royal Ulsterman, which was an Irish packet, I suppose, just doing the cross run between probably Stranraer and Northern Ireland. We were allocated places, bunks, and then we were sort of just wait to see what happened. And group of people that I was with, we were all right in the back of the ship. You couldn't get any further out without falling out over the end. And it was a triangular shaped room as the sides of the ship tapered towards the stern. Royal Ulsterman got twin screws, and the bunks that we had were over the screw tunnels so that we could feel the vibration of the propellers as they went round.
What were conditions like in your mess deck?
Well, we were given our food in... we had some, mess tins. Yes, there was it was a two-piece thing with folding handles. And we used to attend on the deck near the cookhouse arrangement. And you went past one by one, and in your two pieces of the mess tin, and also you had a mug as well. You got tea or coffee or whatever it was, tea mainly, in the mug, and you've got the meal that you ate in the two tops of the tins. And well, if it had to mix, it mixed a bit, but the food was okay. It was it wasn't exactly hot by the time you got into one of the spaces below deck allocated for eating. But it wasn't, it proved not to be a very long journey.
Now, you're going sort of, I think it's 4 or 5 days, 4th to the 9th of April, I think it is.
Hmm.
And you're going to Reykjavik. What about seasickness? I mean, it can be quite rough at that time of the year. I mean, was there any problem with seasickness?
Not with me. There was a chap called Fairley. He suffered from seasickness quite severely. And this part of the his service was quite a torturous event. He certainly was, he was laid out in anything but very rough weather. Anyhow, he survived to Reykjavik. And
do you remember anything about the journey, or was it just...
Well, it was quite spectacular, because we went up between the Outer Hebrides and the mainland, and there was snow on all the hills, and it was... rather chilly, grey sort of weather, so the whole thing had a very sombre effect. But it was quite spectacular, I must say. With the
were you in convoy, or were you escorted individually?
No, we were just on our own. As far as I can remember, I think we picked up a destroyer at some point, because I remember us getting into Reykjavik Harbour, and this destroyer pulling past at quite a quite close by. The whole object there, of course, was for us to disembark and get onto a much larger vessel.
So you didn't actually get ashore at...
Not at all, no. We had a sort of a passage from one ship to the other in a, I don't know what they call them, pinnace or a boat or some sort, something like a large lifeboat. And we had to struggle up the gangway with our kit bags and what have you. One of the cases that not having too much gear was a good thing. But this was a much larger vessel. I think it was the Derbyshire. I think it had been used as a trooper on occasions before. But we, as far as I can remember, we didn't get normal accommodation there. We sort of had to share it with the crew. The crew was quite numerous. It was an armed merchant cruiser, and I remember laying on the floor, we had sleeping bags issued to us. Now, whether we were given those at Wilmslow or whether we got them, I think it must have been. Because we used them on the Ulsterman. So I was on the Derbyshire, I spent the sleeping time on the floor, and there was perhaps three crew in the same cabin. But the food there, of course, as with most of the Navy, was very acceptable, and we just ate in with the... rankers in the Navy men's mess.
Now, so you're now heading across the Atlantic, I presume.
That's right. Yes.
Anything about the journey?
Well, we seem to be in rather dull, grimish weather most of the time. We were joined not far out of Reykjavik by four destroyers, and we also rendezvoused there with a battle cruiser. What was the name of it?
If it's a battleship, it's HMS Resolution.
Yes, it was the Resolution. I think there is some technical difference between a battleship and a battle cruiser. I was told. Post-war that it was a battle cruiser by somebody who'd served in the Navy. So I'm only repeating what he told me. But that was quite a magnificent ship, and the four destroyers were there mainly for the battleship then. And it was going over, I understand, to Boston or somewhere in that direction for refitting. In the heavy weather, they swung the front turrets round so that the weight was back off the bows to a certain extent. But it certainly ploughed through the waves at a quite considerable rate. I don't really recall that there was much in the of an event in the when we were on the Derbyshire. We used to have one or two sort of lectures on general matters just to sort of keep us going. We had a certain amount of physical training, like runs round the ship so many times, and greatly the time was our own. We could spend it talking, reading, doing what we liked. The days passed. Occasionally we heard some loud thumps, and in the if you were down below water level, then of course you felt the bang as it travelled, sound travelled, and the sort of vibration travelled. I presume that somebody was letting off depth charges somewhere out towards the horizon, but there was nothing close by, and the we occasionally had an aircraft rendezvous with us, and it was swept around two or three times and then went off again, and I can't tell you what type of aircraft there were. They were just sort of twin-engined aircraft, probably American by their general shape. We also had now was this on the way out? I seem to recall that there was one of the when the destroyers had a seaplane on board. I could have got a strong vision of it, and I think in this time it was intended that it should use for some sort of defence, but I never saw it go off. So it had facility for landing, but the mid-Atlantic is not a very safe place to put seaplane down with just two floats.
So what about when you start to approach Canada? You come into where? Halifax?
Halifax. Oh, yes. One morning, it was quite a pleasant morning. I seem to remember the sun was shining, we were up. And suddenly we sort of put on speed, because we've been going at convoy speed. And we left the Resolution and the four destroyers behind, and they sort of swung off down towards the south, and we proceeded on our own for the last 6 or 7 hours, I suppose, into Halifax on our own, where we passed through the boom. The tugs at either end of it pulled the obstruction away so that we could pass through, and then they closed the boom up after us, and we went upstream a bit into Halifax itself.
What were your first impressions of Halifax?
Didn't see much of it, to be quite honest, because within a very short time there was the instruction to just get ourselves and our kit off the ship and onto the quayside, which we did.
You got there, well, it looks like about 18th of April, yes. Did you send a telegram?
Yes, that became available to us. I seem to remember with the kit planted on the quayside there, then there was another chap and myself were sort of allocated to see that it got onto our particular carriage in the train. So we jumped on the vehicle, which had been loaded up with the bags and things, and went down towards where the train was, and unloaded it. Other people were doing the same thing, but I did it for our... I don't even remember who it was that accompanied me, but we unloaded the gear anyhow and for the people to pick up later. I went up on the top deck before we abandoned our connection with the Derbyshire, and took the odd picture, and I got choked off for it by a lieutenant in the Navy. And anyhow, he said, "Well, I don't suppose it's any problem. It was only just general pictures." And I got away from him with just a sort of warning, saying, "Well, it is military, so you better be careful in the future." And that was the only episode at Halifax that I would call.
And what about your train journey? Where were you going to? That's what you were going
from. Well, we weren't really sure exactly where we were, and we weren't really sure where we were going, but we got onto the train, and in the late afternoon, early evening time, then we were sorting ourselves out on the in the carriage. It was quite a long train. It was nothing else but troops on it, and the food was organised. It's how did we get the food? It must have been brought through from a kitchen carriage. And it was allocated to us because we had tables, and I think it was four at the table on each side. There was no real finesse about it at all. It was just a trooper, and we got the food. When the evening came, then of course the top bunks came down, and the bottom seating accommodation, the table dropped into a slot, and beds were made there. There were curtains swung along so that the people could undress sitting on their beds and get into bed without sort of being in public gaze, so to speak. This was very similar to the arrangement which passenger trains as they were used by the public, so that it wasn't anything unusual as a trooper. It was just the use of ordinary rolling stock.
Now, this was a hell of a journey you were going on to, well, by English standards anyway, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was quite long. we sort of pressed on north, and then we sort of swung west, and then we were going west, and then further west. But we were told that that we were going to have to make a change. Now, oh dear, where did we make a change? Montreal.
There's a short break between Toronto and Goderich, and then there's a halt at Mont Joly, Quebec, so whichever.
Yes, Mont Joly was one of the places we called at. The greater part of the track, anyhow, for the first distance, was just single line. Which means that the you had to have passing points here and there, and very often it was at a small town, or sometimes it was just in open countryside, and the line divided into two, and you had to wait on your section until the oncoming train went through on his, and you then resumed your journey. The journey itself was punctuated by the horn being blown by the engine up in front, woo woo sort of thing. Which seemed to echo quite considerably in the countryside there, coming off the trees and what have you. But it's pretty wild stuff.
What was the scenery? You seem to have gone alongside the lakes, or Lake Ontario anyway, for a long time.
There was quite a lot of water one way or another. The trees were virtually bare at that time. There was quite a lot of snow and ice about. And I can remember we stopped at one station, which one it was, I'm not sure now, but and we got out to stretch our legs on the platform, which was quite low down, almost level with the track, and the snow and ice was quite considerable, and the air was very very cold indeed. But I think we must have been heading slightly south as well, because it was gradually getting warmer, so that when we got to Montreal, having stopped two or three places for 10, 20, 30 minutes sometimes. Obviously waiting for the trains coming in the other direction. Then we did get a little look at the towns, but no more than perhaps a couple of 300 yards away from the train in the waiting in the platform. And as soon as he got a blast on the horn, then you heard it back to make sure you weren't left behind.